From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Jason Ramirez attended a new school almost every year of his childhood, bouncing around from apartments to shelters to the homes of relatives because his parents, both addicted to heroin, could not give him and his sisters a stable home. But once he set his sights on becoming a doctor, he was locked onto that dream. Today, Dr. Jason Ramirez is a family medicine physician and faculty member at the University of Maryland Med School. In his memoir, The Hard Way, A Doctor's Fight Against Addiction, Poverty, and Depression, he explains how witnessing his parents' drug use taught him to empathize with patients who struggle with addiction.
Remember that they are people, they have a disease, and we have to recognize that, and we have to do our best to care for them like we would anybody else.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Jason Ramirez grew up the son of parents addicted to heroin, in and out of relatives' homes and homeless shelters. At his medical school interview, after hearing about Ramirez's life, his interviewer asked, "You should either be strung out on the streets, in jail, or dead. You're here. How?" It's a question Ramirez has pondered deeply in his new memoir, The Hard Way, A Doctor's Fight Against Addiction, Poverty, and Depression. Today, Jason Ramirez practices family medicine and is director of the Family Medicine Residency Program at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He's here in the studio with me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
When did you realize that your parents were using drugs?
I probably was about 6 or 7 when I started to realize something was just not normal, or they weren't acting like typical parents. I, from time to time, saw them doing things that were peculiar.
Like?
I didn't know. Well, they would hide, and they would go into their bedrooms a lot, or there'd be strange people that would come over to the house, and they would always run into the bedroom doing whatever I didn't know initially. And then they would come out, and they would always be very tired. You know, from just a little kid standpoint, I'd be like, "Why are they so tired?"
Nodding.
Later, I realized that they were high, and they would be nodding out. And then I realized more and more, with my parents specifically, that you know, my father would a lot of times be in the living room, just on the floor, knees on the floor, just head down, nodding off. And my mother the same way, usually in a chair.
Did it scare you?
You know, that's a great question. I don't ever remember being scared, because it really was just an everyday thing. It was the norm. And to be honest, I don't know that I knew any better, because that's all I ever knew. I didn't go over other friends' house and see what other parents were like very often.
Your family moved around a lot, sometimes staying with relatives, sometimes at shelters. How did that instability affect your family?
For me, the most difficult thing was just being bounced from school to school. I mean, it was rare that I was ever in a school more than, you know, 1 or 2 consecutive years, and actually missed half of my freshman year because we were homeless and we didn't have a place to live, and you can't register for school if you don't have a home address. But again, that was what we knew. It was from one poor housing situation to a family's basement, to the family saying we've had enough, you know, to another poor apartment, and then getting evicted from there. It just was a continuous cycle.
So there was all that moving around, but you felt pretty secure with your parents, right?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't fun moving around all the time, but I actually did feel, you know, somewhat secure. And my mentality was, since I was 8, though, has been I had to be a provider for my siblings. When I was 8, my first sister was born. And it really became, okay, here you go, changing diapers, feeding, started to cook for the family, started to clean for the family, started to be left alone with an infant at a young age while they would go out and try and, you know, find their drugs. Or if they were, sometimes if they had a period where they had some stable employment. My summers were not spent having fun. They were always spent caring for my siblings.
And how did that affect your relationship with your sisters?
My relationship was very authoritative, I would say. It was like I was...
You were in charge.
I was in charge. I was pretty hard on them. I demanded respect from my parents, even though...
From your parents?
From my siblings to my parents. Like, I that was very big for me. I was, you know, they would say things as they were starting, particularly my first sister, who was 8 years younger than me. If she started disrespecting or bad-mouthing my parents, I let her know that that was not acceptable, no matter what. And as adults now, we're kind of separated, and we don't talk too much. We've reconnected a little bit, but for a long time, we didn't talk.
That's Jason Ramirez, family medicine doctor, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his memoir, The Hard Way, in which he describes how he made his way through medical school while dealing with the challenges of parental addiction and homelessness. High school was a bumpy time for you. You, as you said, you missed a half year while your family was living in a shelter. You were mostly a C student. And then something changed that.
Education really wasn't stress or push. If I came home with C's, my parents were like, "Dad, that's great, son." They, you know, they tried to be encouraging. I would take it. That was their way of being encouraging. So I didn't necessarily care that much until I started halfway through 10th grade. It was a chemistry class, I remember. It was a pretty tough class, and not many students got good grades. But I noticed the kids that did get good grades were getting praise. And I started to want that. I'm like, why them and why not me? I wasn't getting necessarily praise at home or from anybody else. And I realized, well, these kids are getting something that I wanted, but I can do this too. There was, for whatever reason, there was a little doubt. And I decided that I was going to do well and get the good grades and get the recognition from teachers that the other students were. And once I put my mind to it, it started to happen. I ended up doing well in that chemistry class, and that just led to other advanced classes, the recognition that I saw other kids getting, and I liked it. There was no doubt about it.
So you transformed from a C student to an A student.
To an A student, yeah.
In like a semester.
Yeah.
Money was always tight in your family, but you were able to attend Emory University in Georgia. How could you afford college?
When you're very, very, very poor, Emory University, at least then, they guarantee 100% of your financial need. I had a lot of financial need. Once I got accepted, they gave me a very generous scholarship package. My first year was only $3,000 short, and a doctor, a pediatrician that went to the church that I had been going to at that time, heard about my story and said there was no way that I was not going to go to that school because of $3,000, and he basically paid the $3,000 for me. The subsequent years, Emory ended up paying the full way for me. So it was,
when did you set your sights on becoming a doctor?
It was actually not until I was 17. I had loved teaching. I was going to be a teacher. Biology was my thing. I was going to teach biology all the way up until about a month before graduating high school, actually. And then that same pediatrician gave me a book that really changed the direction of my future. The book was Gifted Hands by Dr. Benjamin Carson, and I read that book, and I saw a similarity in him and in me, and I said, hey, he came from a single-parent family, very poor, and now he's a world-renowned pediatric neurosurgeon. So I was like, oh, I'm going to be a pediatric neurosurgeon. What does it take to do that? And people were like, you got to go to medical school. And I didn't know anything. I wasn't any of the wiser. I said, okay, well, then that's what I'm going to do.
And you were in your last semester of college when you first encountered depression after your uncle called with news that your grandmother had died. Did you recognize what was going on with you?
I had very little understanding. I mean, I noticed that I would start missing classes and I'd be sleeping. I just would sleep. But I didn't know what was going on or why. The last semester, I was in jeopardy of not passing the semester because of that. Until the very end, I had to ace a bunch of tests. And fortunately, I turned around and said, okay, I need to do this.
And we're going to pick up the story. We have to take a quick break here on the record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, more with physician and author Jason Ramirez. We'll talk about equipping doctors in training to handle the country's opioid overdose epidemic. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Becoming a doctor is one of the most challenging career paths a person can choose. The challenges of that path are amplified when you also face homelessness and coping with parents with substance abuse issues. I'm speaking with Jason Ramirez, director of the Family Medicine Residency Program at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He's just published The Hard Way, A Doctor's Fight Against Addiction, Poverty, and Depression. Depression hit you in college, and then it hit you again when your father died and you were a resident, a surgical, right? You were studying to be a surgeon at that point. How did that affect your schooling?
The depression after my father passed away got so severe that it cut my surgical career short very quickly. When I, again, was struggling so much to even just to get to work, it's not compatible with any job, never mind a medical residency of any kind. And I was asked to leave my surgical training program if I could not improve or do my responsibilities, and I couldn't, and I realized that I had to make a change and do something to help myself because I was just going down a path where I didn't see any recovery happening. So I left my surgical program and was fortunate enough to get a family medicine training program where I started working in and did well initially, but still had some periods of ups and downs with my depression.
By that point, you were in treatment for depression?
Everything I had done up until that point in my life, I felt I had done on my own. And I thought, I can control this and I can beat this. I didn't realize that I needed help. I didn't value the input of others. And that's, I think, what delayed me kind of getting into recovery from my depression.
But eventually, what happened?
After 2 years of residency, that had ups and downs, I reached out to a faculty member and I confided in her and I said, hey, I really need some help. I want to succeed. I don't want to not do well, and I want to be a good doctor, but there are things holding me back and I think it's depression. And she agreed. We agreed to try medications and get some therapy, and I started doing that. Unfortunately, the initiation of the medication kind of triggered an anger spell one day, and I got into a verbal conflict at work that led to my departure from my family medicine training program.
Verbal conflict is a pretty mild way of describing what you go into in some detail in the book. You really lashed out in a very unprofessional way, verbally.
Correct.
To a colleague. And you were called on the carpet for it and essentially ended up getting fired from that residency, too.
Correct.
And a colleague told you at that time that you weren't a good enough person to be a doctor.
It was a faculty member of mine at the time, and they point blank told me that I was not good enough of a person to be a physician, which I never believed. I believed that it was they didn't know who I was as a person. And I felt very hurt by that for a decade and a half after that, because those are pretty tough words to digest.
But you didn't internalize it. You didn't think it was true.
Well, I did not believe it was true at all.
Your temper, though, did you consider it might be a problem in dealing with patients?
No.
As well as colleagues?
So it makes sense, but there's a huge difference in the way I work and interact with patients. I will never, and I never have claimed to be the smartest doctor in the world, but my bedside manners is what I would say is very good. And my work ethic is very strong. And those things are things that sometimes my faculty members couldn't see because they weren't directly witnessing what I was doing. So when they said, "Oh, you're not good enough of a person," my thoughts were, "How do you know? You don't ever watch me with patients. You don't watch me when I'm at my best."
So at this point, you had failed out of two residencies. You managed to find another one and complete your residency and become a doctor. How do you bounce back like that?
Well, let's just say the third one wasn't exactly a piece of cake either, but I did make it through. I did, you know, have some faculty who said, "You have a big chip on your shoulder and you need to shape up or things aren't going to be well for you." And I remember my program director at the time pulling me aside one day, and this may have been something that really changed the way I thought of myself and my future, but he said, "You know, there's a lot of faculty here that want you gone from this residency, but I can't let that happen. You're one of the brightest residents I've had in 25 years of teaching, but you have to adjust your attitude and you have to learn to deal with your colleagues a little bit more professionally." And I respected him. I respected him a lot. And those words, he wasn't telling me I wasn't a good person. He was giving me constructive feedback. And then life started blossoming when I came back up kind of home and followed the woman of my dreams and got married. And then everything seemed to fall into place.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jason Ramirez, family medicine doctor. We're talking about his memoir, The Hard Way, A Doctor's Fight Against Addiction, Poverty, and Depression. Your father died right before medical school graduation. You lost your mother while you were working in private practice. Both of their deaths were related to substance abuse. Do you feel they were proud of what you had achieved?
I do. My father never got to know me as a doctor, but he was very proud that I made it to that level. I kept the last letter he ever wrote me, and I have it on my wall, actually framed in my office at work, where he talks about how proud he is. And my mother was also very proud. I know that. I've never doubted that.
Did becoming a father yourself change how you felt about your own childhood?
It didn't change how I felt about my childhood. It definitely was something that I struggled with, whether I wanted to become a parent because of my childhood, fearing that I just wouldn't be a good enough parent.
How'd you get over that? Or have you?
It just happened. And one day, you know, my wife came to me and said, we're blessed with becoming pregnant and we're going to have a family. And it took a little bit of time for me to digest that, but I did. And then I just made it a point that, you know what, I'm going to be the best father that I can be, and that's there's not going to be any question about that.
As you know better than I, the number of deaths caused by opioid overdoses has soared. As director of the family medicine residence at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, what do you tell them about working with patients who have histories of addiction or who have family members with substance abuse issues?
So as you can imagine, it definitely becomes personal to me a lot of times. And we're seeing them in the office, I'm seeing them in the hospital, patients with opioid abuse. What my message to the residents is, remember that they are people like anybody else. They have a disease, and we have to recognize that, and we have to do our best to care for them like we would anybody else. That message, I think, comes through very clearly when I educate the residents. Not that they're, you know, more difficult of a patient or anything else. They're just a patient coming to us who has a concern or a complaint or a problem, and we have to have compassion as if they were our mother or father that we were taking care of.
How has being the child of parents with substance abuse disorder helped you connect to patients who have that problem?
It's interesting. Sometimes it can go both ways. Sometimes it's a mental block. And what I mean by that is there are things that we can do for medication-assisted treatments that you can get specially trained for, and I haven't to this point, and some of it has been because of just my background. Other times, there have been times when I've had a very, very, very emotional and touching encounters with patients where I've shared my story, which isn't often.
Tell me about one of those.
There was this one particular encounter that I write about in the book where, young woman was having a lot of abdominal complaints, pain, nausea, vomiting, couldn't eat because she would just throw up. And she had been in the hospital for a month, and nobody, you know, specialists on board, nobody can figure out what was going on. I couldn't accept the fact that there was nothing wrong. There had to be something that was explaining her symptoms, because I believed her. There was no doubt that this woman was suffering. There was with pain and nausea and vomiting. I saw her throwing up. So one day I went and I just said, I'm going to go talk to her. And went up to her room, started asking her questions. Again, oh, doc, you don't know what I'm going through. You don't know anything. And I just was overcome with the urge to share my story and to tell her that I do. I knew she had an addiction problem from her history, medical history. And I thought somehow that was related to her symptoms. And I said, you know, I don't know what you're going through, but I do know what it's like to be in an environment of addiction, and particularly heroin addiction. And the most beautiful thing happened. She listened to my story, then got up. She gave me a hug, and she said, you know, doc, I'm hungry. And I was floored. I just ran out and I told the nurse, give me some food. And she brought some food in, and this is a woman who couldn't even drink anything. And she ate a whole plate of food, kept it down, and was fine, and was discharged the next day, went home the next day. And so her whole process, what she replied to me was, you know, I needed to hear that story, because what's really happening is I'm so concerned about, I have no money, and I was on a medication called Suboxone to help me with my addiction, but I lost my insurance. I couldn't get the medication anymore, and I was so worried of going back out on the street and using again. And then all these symptoms happened, and she wasn't doing it on purpose. It was not her intent to do these things, but it was all part of her condition, and it was all taken away by sharing my story.
When you think back to that medical school interviewer who heard your story and said, why aren't you strung out in the streets or in prison or dead, how would you answer that now?
Probably the same way I did then. I said, well, I want to be a doctor. If you know any other way than another 4+ years of schooling and another who knows how many hundreds of thousands of dollars, then please let me know and I'll do it. But
obviously there was a deeper question there. How did you pull it together?
You know, again, I still think that my life would be totally different if I didn't have the siblings that I had. Did I like never having summer vacations? No. Did I like always having to hear crying babies and cleaning up the house and cooking and cleaning? No, I didn't. But if I had just had the liberty of going out on the, you know, and getting into trouble with the wrong groups of people or friends, my life probably would have been a lot different. You know, what took a long time, though, from that environment was learning social skills. You know, I think that's what kind of held me back a lot during college and medical school and residency, is those social skills. I had this I can do it and I don't need you attitude that obviously wasn't healthy. And because of that, I don't have any friends or contacts from high school, from college, from medical school, from residency.
But you have this wonderful wife.
I have the most amazing wife, yes. Absolutely.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Thanks.
Thank you.
Jason Ramirez is a family medicine doctor and director of the Family Medicine Residency Program at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He's author of The Hard Way, A Doctor's Fight Against Addiction, Poverty, and Depression. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.